You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight, we are going to be talking about the long-anticipated, much eagerly awaited return of the second half of the split Doctor Who season, whatever season this is.
I think it's six.
Season of the Silence. And the long-promised episode at the end of A Good Man Goes to War called Let's Kill Hitler.
What
surely,
a title.
Surely a joking and fun little romp this is bound to be, right?
Yeah, my thoughts.
Now, typically Ben and I don't discuss these episodes in advance before we do the podcast because we want that to be spontaneous. But unfortunately, we do have an inkling at this stage of the game what each other think of this episode. And we also, I think reasonably, have an inclination of what people have said on the internet with regards to this episode. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that a vast majority of those people are just absolutely wrong about this episode.
I would have to agree.
This episode stunk.
Mm-hmm.
Without doubt, the worst episode of Matt Smith's time as the Doctor. I can't think of one that I actively disliked as much as I dislike this episode.
I would agree.
And since Ben agrees, Ben, you go first.
Well, I'll say that when I was watching it numerous times, I kept having to pause, and I looked at my partner, Keith, and he looked back at me, and we would just both shake our heads. And then I just finally tweeted that I never thought that I could see an episode that I would dislike as much as The Impossible Astronaut until now. Let's Kill Hitler is a piece of trash.
I really thought it was a train wreck, yeah. There are some minor things. Obviously, there's something to recommend it, because probably what I can see, maybe 67 to 75% of Doctor Who viewers thought it was just the greatest thing Stephen Moffat had ever done. And I don't see that. And I have yet to see anybody review it or make statements on it that says anything other than, I was just entertained for an hour. Wow! Not the slightest bit of thought in that at all. It appears to be purely on an emotional level. And on an emotional level,
yeah.
When I rewatched it, there's a little bit going on there. But unfortunately, I can't watch a program and disengage my brain. It doesn't work that way for me. And so, therefore, all I saw was, hey, that's stupid. Hey, that's wrong. Hey, mm-hmm. that's stupid. Hey, mm-hmm. that's stupid. Hey, that's wrong. And it just kept going and it, going.
And the more and going. The more you watch it, it's like the worse it got to me. So there was an emotional response. It was one of complete disgust and alienation. I really intensely disliked this episode. And as far as people who've liked it, now I've only read two little bits of writing on this. One's from a friend of mine who lives in London, works for the BBC, and another one is Colin Baker. And both of them actually kind of nailed it on the same thing. They loved this
non-linear time
turvy, yeah, this non-linear time travel nonsense. How
yes.
time is basically just turned inside out into a pretzel in terms of people's timelines. That and they just don't give a hoot at the fact that, you know, there's there has to be some sense of cause and effect and consequence and a sense of direction with all of this, a sense of structure. And I mean, that's anytime I watch anything that involves time travel, I always approach it from that point of view. And both Colin and John just didn't see that at all.
Okay, to be fair, Colin Baker's review was a tweet. I mean,
it was, but it was he pretty much he it was about how Doctor Who it was he almost implied that it was his favorite. And that this is what Doctor Who's supposed to be. It's not supposed to make sense.
So here is the thing to me. Let's talk about that timeline. So movies. This is an interesting discussion we can go into for a moment. And it reminds me of a story where I think it was Brett Ratner was making a film with Jackie Chan. So that would have been Rush Hour. Probably Rush Hour.
I think so.
And, of course, Brett Ratner was like a first-time director, and he was rightly allowing Jackie Chan to do the choreography for the fight sequences and taking advice from him. But they had this sequence where they needed to get a gun and, you know, they needed to pick up a gun. Somebody needed to pick up a gun. I don't know what the gun was. And Jackie Chan would go through this elaborate thing, and then Ratner would go, but where do they get the gun? Well, he picks it up. But where is the gun? You have to show the gun. The audience is too... He didn't say this in these words, but this is the bottom line. The audience is too stupid to derive from the fact that they've got 15 armed guys getting the poo beat out of them by Jackie Chan in a kung fu fight, that there might be a gun that gets knocked on the floor or falls out of somebody's pocket or is lying around in the room. They've got to explicitly show the gun arriving in the place where the gun has to be. And that says your audience is too stupid to do. But there is a line. There is a line where you can just suddenly pull a gun out of your trousers, where you've obviously not had a gun for the rest of the film, and the audience will balk at this. I mean, there's a fine line at this. But what they're doing is playing a game where the guy can pull a gun out of his trousers when he obviously doesn't have one, and then when somebody says, how did you pull a gun out of your trousers? He says, oh yeah, I'd better go stick one there by time travel now.
That is so Bill and Ted.
Yes, it is. It is a scene from Bill and Ted.
It's right out of Bill and Ted with the car keys. He says, I know. Yeah, I will travel in the future, grab my dad's car keys, and put them right here behind this post. Here they are. Now, okay, in that particular case, it worked because it was supposed to be a joke. But when you're trying to do it in a serious setting, it doesn't fly.
And you're doing it over and over and over again.
I mean, the whole thing. Way too many times.
Somebody's review said this type of storytelling by Moffat has gotten so that Moffat's like a drunken roommate who keeps telling the same story over and over again, because it's exactly what he's doing now. We've seen this one basically every time River Song shows up. We're getting this. I'm going to tell the story whack at a time. And it's novel, but he's gone to the well too many times, and timey-wimey just doesn't cut it anymore.
Well, I don't necessarily have a problem with the idea of what – because what we're seeing here is essentially effect and cause, not cause and effect. We're seeing the result before we see how the result came to be.
But if the Doctor were really going to play time like that, then none of his stories would ever have to make sense, because he just simply solved them before he got there in the first place.
You run the risk here of
then carrying this to its logical conclusion, which is, oh yeah, by the way, well, then nothing need make sense ever again. I can just solve all my problems by solving them later, beforehand.
What I was going to say is that, okay, true, if you're going to project that outside of this current story arc that we're dealing with, I just want to focus solely on this episode and why it doesn't fly.
Okay.
We have a situation Well, we might as well talk about River and her crime. Mm-hmm. It is confirmed in this episode that River Song, a.k.a. Melody Pond, did indeed kill the Doctor. She kills him on April 22nd?
2011.
Okay, 2011. That is the date of The Impossible Astronaut, when it first opens up. Yep. And you see our intrepid people having a nice little cheese and wine right by Lake Pleasant. It's that date.
Yes.
We have this Justice Department who we'll get into the specifics on what's everything that's wrong with them.
I do want to say one thing though. Their files consider her to be a worse war criminal than Hitler.
True.
A man who single-handedly ordered the murder of 6 million Jews, gays, gypsies, disabled people, and who launched a war that killed 60 million people. Riverside, I don't care how important the Doctor is, I find it hard to believe that killing the Doctor constitutes a greater war crime than that. It's almost an insult to... And I don't take offense to things like that very often, but that one I found insulting.
It did seem a bit much. In any case, it becomes clear that this Justice Department, they have time travel because they have computer files that go into the future. They have a computer file on Melody Pond or River Song. And... Oh. It clearly shows that in 2011, this person kills the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here is where the effect and cause doesn't quite seem to really jive. Because now we have this River Song now, or she's still Melody Pond. She hasn't taken on the identity of River Song yet. And still under the influence of whoever it is that brainwashed her, tries to kill the Doctor. We're back in World War II in Hitler's office. She tries to kill the Doctor with toxic lipstick. And yet their files don't properly reflect. I don't know. If for some reason the whole timey-wimey thing just didn't quite seem to really work for me. I'm losing my thoughts here.
Non-linear plots do that.
Well, yeah, it's true. There was just something that didn't quite. It felt kind of strange because they should have known.
They did know that he died somewhere else.
Yeah, they know that he dies in the future.
But they also knew that he was dying then, and they also knew that it's not possible that he dies then, because that's a fixed point in time. And that's his death in 2011 is a fixed point in time and cannot be changed.
I think this is the part that bothered me. This is what bothered me, and we have to touch on this in greater detail. River, or Mel, we'll call her Mel for now, she does save the Doctor's life. How she goes about that, we will discuss later. But she does save his life at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we know from past episodes, Flesh and Stone, episodes of that nature, where River has been sentenced to jail for murder.
Mm-hmm.
And we do learn here that it is the Doctor that she has indeed killed.
That may not be why she's in prison, though.
It's a safe bet, really. I mean, I suppose it is possible that Moffat could pull a trump card, but I don't think he's going in that direction. I really don't. The implications are pretty strong that she went to Stormcage, the prison planet, for killing the Doctor as a young child. At some point, they nab her, and she gets sentenced there.
But we don't know if she killed him as a young child, either. We don't know that. We don't know that what's in the astronaut is her as a young child. It could be. Who knows what it is? I don't think it's as straightforward as we think. In fact, I'd almost probably go out on a limb and say it probably wasn't her who kills the doctor in The Impossible Astronaut, but that for some reason she takes the blame for it.
Well, here's where I disagree with that, because, and again, it's not outright stated, but it is heavily implied. When the doctor inquires River, when he asks of River, "Who did you kill?" She looks at him, and with great personal pain, she looks back at him and says, "A very good man." She wouldn't say who. Now, we've all been guessing, oh, it must be the doctor. And I kept hoping beyond hope that we were going to be seeing this story go in another direction. And so far, we haven't been. Now, I'm just going to follow the logical conclusion here, because Moffat is not surprising me in the good ways. He's only surprising me in the bad ways, which suggests to me even more so that it is indeed River who did kill the doctor at some point in her life. She has memory of this. Her expression, the way she communicated that to the doctor in past episodes, proves that. She has memory of what she has done. She knows the gravity of her crime. That's why I am convinced that it is young Mel who was inside that space, spacesuit.
Well, only time will tell. I think that's going to be another episode we'll probably be disappointed by when we get to the River of Wedding Song, or vice versa.
I'm sure you're right. But the point that I was initially going to make, though, is we have this Justice Department. They have now witnessed Mel save the doctor's life.
They didn't actually witness it. They were gone.
Were they gone?
Yeah, they got beamed up before.
I don't care if they got beamed up or not. Those people, whoever dispatches them, has got pretty accurate knowledge of history.
It's not very accurate. They arrived in 1938 instead of 1940X.
Well, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so they landed. Okay, so they have a ship that they screw up in their time space coordinates. But the fact is, they have detailed records. They knew what happens to the doctor. They knew who it is that they had intended originally to eliminate. Just because they were there at the wrong time doesn't really seem to matter. Okay, so the destinations don't quite jive. But they still have accurate records as to who kills who, where, what, why.
Okay, here's another one.
I cannot accept that they don't know that an older version of Mel has saved the doctor's life.
Okay, but here's one more for you. Okay? If the stated purpose of this Justice Department's Tesseract machine, which they were pretty clear, said they go after war criminals or major criminals who do not get punished in their lifetime. River Song is in prison for her crimes.
That's a very good one.
So she has been punished for her crimes in her lifetime, unlike Hitler, who got away with it by killing himself.
Not to mention the fact that they should also know
that she was in prison for that.
She will actually sacrifice. I mean, granted, it will happen after she's pardoned. After she is pardoned from her crime, released, whatever. But after, because when we first meet her in Silence of the Library, she is a free woman.
Yes.
And she's an archaeologist.
So she's paid her crime, yes.
She pays the ultimate price by saving the doctor's life
again
at the end. At the end of the second part of that story. And yet they have nothing on that. I cannot believe it. This is the point that I have with this whole cause and effect game that they're playing here. If Moffat is going to play by the idea that we can witness effect and cause. We can see this in reverse order. Then you have to establish that anybody who can time travel extensively and have extensive records as well should be able to abide by those exact same rules. And they don't. It's inconsistent. And I cannot accept this is where the story really starts to fall apart for me. If you're going to establish a set of rules, if you're going to say, okay, this is how we're going to play in my sandbox, okay, fine. Well, then you need to abide by your own rules as well. And Moffat isn't. He establishes a set of rules, and then he breaks them left and right at his own convenience. And that makes the episode, from that standpoint alone, totally fall apart.
Well, let's talk about little things that you know, we're not going to resolve the issue with the time going around, but I have a feeling that we're going to keep coming back to it. But I have a few.
We will never resolve it because there is
no resolution for it. It's just wrong, and it's going to be.
It's wrong, and that's the way it is. And I don't think there's any way he can repair the damage.
One of the things that people I have heard talk about, apart from the just that was just entertaining, was the, you know, I love how Moffat keeps throwing me these twists. And the first of those twists would be how Rory and Amy contact the Doctor, the crop circle in Leedsworth. And they drive the car around, spell out the word the Doctor. When they arrive, finishing the crop circle, there is the Doctor. Rory looks at the newspaper, and it's not the crop circle that they made because there's a line through it. Where'd the line come through? In Dodge's the sports car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everyone knows that has to be River Song because that's
the
way it works.
I mean, I'm watching, and I'm, you know, as soon as the car pulls up, I expect the door to open up, and I expect to hear "Hello, sweetie,"
and then out pops Mels, the totally unheard of character who is now suddenly the inseparable childhood friend of Rory and Amy, and I didn't like that.
I didn't either.
And I thought, oh, come on, that's really too much of a ridiculous retcon. I know that you rebooted the universe, and so I suppose we could argue that in the rebooted universe, Amy and Rory did in fact have a pal named Mels. The Doctor didn't meet her at the wedding because she doesn't do weddings, but nonetheless, I find it hard to believe.
Rebooted universe or not, it doesn't matter. The way she was just thrown into this mix...
It was a mess.
I mean, the only thing that partially redeems it, and I say partially, is the revelation that as to who Mels really is. But it's not still didn't work for me. I mean, I kept thinking, who the heck is this person? I mean, if they could have just thrown out a stupid little line where the Doctor said, "Oh yeah, we could have never seen her before." The Doctor could have said something like, "Oh yes, I did see you at the wedding," and that would have been okay.
If we'd had,
I actually would have been fine with that. You know, it's just a simple, stupid little line. "Yeah, I did see you at the wedding. You didn't want to dance with me," and just leave it at that. Some just throwaway little line.
Or if they'd mentioned Mels at any point in their history with Leedsworth or Ledsworth or whatever it happens to be, but they never did, and that, to me, says I call bullshit.
Shenanigans.
Yes, I call bullshit. This, you did not have this planned out in advance.
No, he didn't, and I actually have proof on that.
Ooh,
I've got proof that he's winging this.
Okay. Proof away.
This was an interview that I'm not sure when this happened, but it was an interview with Stephen Moffat, and it's called a Hitfix interview. And somebody, the interviewer, asked, "So you knew that you're going to have to tell the story with River and that you'd be in charge to tell it?" Moffat's response is, that wasn't especially my plan. It came about for the most practical of reasons, River. It was because the Doctor, and we're talking David Tennant's Doctor, had to be found in a library that had been sealed off for 100 years, and a team of archaeologists had to walk through that door, and some things the psychic paper won't cover. So I didn't want to have a long section where he was arrested like the show used to have. That'll be boring. And it was really hard actually to get around that. I thought the lamest idea in the world is that one of them knows him, and I felt that was too much of a coincidence. But You can disguise the coincidence, hide it out of sight. If it's somebody he hasn't met yet, and then it's just click, click, click. What if it's a woman? What if it's a woman who flirts with him? And then you think, that's going to upstage the rest of the story, but let's do it anyway. But even at that point, I was thinking that this would be a one-off character. She was designed to be, and maybe she could be canoodling the 45th Doctor, and we wouldn't have to see her again until I'm no longer materially involved in either making or watching it.
Okay, I think that it's reasonable to say that, I mean, I was of the impression that when he did the Silence in the Library, that that was not meant to be a big mystery that we would ever get an answer to. I didn't think, but I do think now that they've started the whole impossible astronaut thread, and that since he took over and Amy Pond and has you know, since his introduction of Amy Pond, if at this point he had worked out River Song's backstory, as he does say he has the whole thing jumbled up there in his head, well, and ready to go, then he has not been putting the pieces together. And this feels like this was added, like, after he wrote The Impossible Astronaut. It feels totally hacked on. It's totally and shoehorned on there.
I do know, with interviews with the other cast members, they have said that Alex Kingston knows the full story, that that Moffat has actually gone up to her and told her everything. But I think the problem was, is he basically painted himself into a corner right from the get-go.
Anytime you do this with a time thingy, you're painting yourself into a bad corner.
If he really should have stuck to his guns and not gone back and revisited River Song. He should have left it alone and be done with it. Instead, he had to go back. He had to deal with her again, and the more he did, the more he was painting himself into a corner until he reached a point where it's like, ah, hell with it. And then he just starts writing the worst crap you can imagine because it's all he had left. And I know I'm going to get hate mail for that one.
Probably. You even seem to dislike it more than I do.
I really hated this episode.
I did not like the episode, but I just see it as shoddy work.
It was very shoddy, but it insulted me.
So we hear Mel's, she's shot, and she talks about her regeneration. And she says, last time I did this, I
was a little girl in New York.
No, she did not say that. She said, I became a toddler in New York City. Which, considering the age of the girl that was regenerating in New York City, that means she actually regenerated into something
younger. Well, hey, we've been seeing the Doctor do it.
Okay, but 1963 was that? So let's regenerate her so that she is now roughly, what? Let's call her a toddler. Let's call her 3 years old. Born in 1960. Still not contemporaneous with Rory and Amy. Not even close. And she said she spent a lot of time finding them.
She spent like 2 years trying to find them, I think is what she says.
I don't remember being
I believe she says 2 years, but I could be wrong.
Or maybe years, or I don't know what it was. But she clearly spent a long time trying to find them, which, of course, she would have had to have grown up from being a toddler before she could have done any of that. And she obviously found them as a fairly young child. I don't know what that earliest Mel's version was, but I guess she was 10.
Same age as Amelia.
Yeah, but what was that? Amelia age 10?
Roughly, no older than.
So, it just doesn't work. I don't like it, and it doesn't work. But. Okay, so we have that. She regenerates. She's sort of Time Lordish. She becomes the River Song we know.
Well, sort of. I mean, in terms of face.
B- body, yeah. I hated the line about I'm going to age younger through this regeneration just to mess with him, just to compensate for the fact that she's frankly looking quite a lot older than she did in Silence in the Library, I think.
I wonder why.
Yeah. It's as if she's not really going in reverse to
well,
the Doctor's
Well, you
time.
Can only play the, I mean, you can there you have to kind of go with the suspension
That's just
of
like
disbelief.
Yeah, just don't even bother to mention it then.
True. they should have never said it.
You can suspend the disbelief because we're supposed to suspend our disbelief, but you don't tell us that.
Yeah.
She gives up her remaining regenerations to save the Doctor after she killed him. Did she give him her remaining regenerations? Did we reset the regeneration limit there? Has the Doctor now got 10 more added onto his life?
Well, apparently he actually has unlimited now.
By what canon piece of...
By Russell Davies.
If you're talking about that, I'll have to bleep that one.
The people that I know...
I mean, it's clearly not meant that way.
I know of a lot of people that have accepted that as part of the Doctor Who canon.
The line is quite simply, and I don't remember what the number is, but it's ridiculous. But the kid, Clyde, is irritating him.
How many times can regenerate? Says unlimited.
No, he does not say unlimited. And if they're taking it as canon, they can't even listen because it's not anything like that.
Well, I certainly didn't hear it, but that's what's being quoted.
They're wrong. It's something. It's a silly number like 527 or 829, something like that. He's clearly making it up. He's irritated. They're walking. They're going backwards through that vent, and the kid's asking him questions. Oh, your face changing. You do this. You do that. And he's, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And he said, how many times you did it? And the Doctor says, he gives him a number. Like I said, 527 or something like that. And then the kid shuts up. And
well, this does go into another thing that is being done. So in a way, we now have this new characteristic of the Doctor.
And
Russell and Davies and Moffat are now co-conspirators in this, and that is the Doctor always lies.
Well, he is the Phantom Trickster.
He's really a liar in this one. And one thing that they did here, which just it pissed me off. Early in the episode when we first meet Mels, they take off in the TARDIS, and she proceeds to shoot her gun. And it puts a bullet hole in the glass column. The time rotor. Now, ever since Hand of Fear, we had been told that the TARDIS existed in a state of temporal grace. That's the only time we've ever seen it work, however. We have seen...
It didn't even work. There was a bluff.
It's the only time we're led to believe that that's the truth. Now, in later episodes, there's constant evidence of...
It doesn't work.
That it doesn't work. So... How does Moffat address that? Oh, the Doctor lied. It's like any time you want to change something that you find inconvenient, you can just now simply say, oh, the Doctor lied.
It's more than that. It's more than that. That scene was another one that bothered me. Not because the Doctor lies, but because... It's utterly unnecessary. Just like River saying, I'm going to age backwards. It's an utterly unnecessary sequence. The Doctor doesn't tell Mels that they exist in a sense of, in a state of temporal grace, because we don't see that scene. She forces him onto the TARDIS, and the next thing you know, she shot it, and... You know, how can this be my fault? You said we existed in a state of temporal grace. Why bring that up?
I think it was simply...
It's to remind people of it back all the way to Hand of Fear or whatever it was. It's strictly for the fans. It's utterly pointless, the story. My kids were, clueless as to what that was going on there because it hadn't It didn't happen. He never told her that. It was irrelevant.
It is entirely irrelevant. I just think it's another one of the things. Moffat likes to address these things every once in a while. He'll take any episode and he'll address, okay, why does – okay, Time and Angels, I think that was the episode where River comes back with Matt Smith's doctor. First time, and we address, well, why is the TARDIS shaking all the time? Ever since Russell took over the show, the TARDIS was shaking like mad. And well, okay, I guess it was something that Moffat didn't like. So what does he do? He writes a throwaway line. Oh, you didn't press the stabilizer. Press the blue stabilizer, and next thing you know, the TARDIS now flies smoothly.
It's reverted to the way it should be.
Right, it's the way it should be, which I liked. I think this is just another one of these things where Moffat saw something that he thought, oh, we need to get rid of this. We need to sweep it under the rug. I know. I'll just infer this stupid little scene in here, and because we're short on time, I'll just imply that it happens.
But it wasn't that anything the doctor that says it. Even was remotely in the new Doctor. I can't imagine why he thought he needed to sweep something under the rug that doesn't – no one who's watching this show from the new series would ever – have heard of that line, and anybody watching the show from the old series would know that the TARDIS doesn't exist in a state of it's just unnecessary little bit of fan wanking again. And
yes, it was. That's precisely what it was.
And it's wasting time. He could have been trying to fix his story.
Well, there's no way on earth he's going to be able to fix this mess.
Could have tried anyway. Could have put the effort.
Not possible.
Okay, so let's take a couple others. Let's talk about the Tesseract. Let's talk about the Justice Department and the
the Terminator robot.
Yeah, they go back in time. They find criminals who weren't punished in their lifetime, and they give them hell, which I presume means they torture them. They go back for Hitler. By the way, Hitler was vaguely in this for a few seconds, but basically he was smacked on the face by Rory and put in a cupboard. And that was the last we saw of Hitler.
Rory has the greatest
line. Shut up, Hitler.
I'm throwing Hitler into the cupboard, which was a great metaphor for, okay, we're going to completely dismiss the whole Hitler aspect in spite of the title.
Yeah, well, you know, you ever see like at the end of the James Bond films where they said James Bond will return in... And then they'd name the next movie.
Right.
And at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, it says James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only.
Right.
And then they made Moonraker instead. Yeah. See, I almost feel like the end of A Good Man Goes to War, they said, next time, let's kill Hitler. And then somewhere in there, somebody came up with the idea of, like, that's not really a very good idea. Let's do something else. And they said, well, we still have to put in the Hitler thing, so let's get that out of the way real quick, and then we'll be done. Again, it just feels like...
it was hackneyed.
Yeah. But the machine, I mean, come on. A miniaturized crew on board a robot. Okay, let's say that the robot is complicated enough that you need a team of people operating it. I will grant that is one theoretical possibility behind running the robot, or perhaps they could have done it by telepresence. But that notwithstanding, let's say you have to shrink the people in there. Would you really make your security system simulate antibodies?
That's not the part that bothered me. What bugged the crud out of me is, in order to see what the heck is going on out there, you have to send somebody up to the head and look out the eye.
That was just so she could get a really accurate look at the skin tones, because she was from the art department. Because they were obviously looking through the screens and seeing what was going on outside the eyes. But yes, and that is silly to go up, look out the eye, and also that they beam people in through the eyes.
For the sake of,
and it isn't like a holding area. I mean, it's just sort of like a corridor that's not guarded or anything. I mean, yes, they've got the antibodies, but if you're just going to beam somebody in with the antibodies, why not just kill them?
I know. It felt like a complete waste.
And why is it that you would go after Hitler, and you're supposed to catch him just before he dies? That's why they don't do anything to him, because he got arrived at the wrong year. Why would you go after him and then torture him just before he dies? But when you capture a Nazi, a general, you know, a minor character in the Third Reich, so that you can duplicate his body. What do they do with him? They leave him to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how is that not messing around with time?
Yeah.
Like, that's just, it's just silly.
It completely takes away any credibility of this Justice Department.
Wait, there's one other thing that takes away that credibility.
What?
Welcome. You are unauthorized. Your death will now be implemented. Welcome. You are unauthorized. It's like, who writes that kind of stupid garbage?
The same person who writes this timey-wimey BS.
Okay. Not having a good Moffat day today.
No.
So the Justice Department seems silly. Is this the same group of people, the time agents that Captain Jack came from?
Oh, God. You know, I never really thought of that, but I doubt it.
Then are they someday, maybe, are humans going to take over the role of the Time Lords? Is that, you know, where are we going on this in the future? I don't know.
Who knows? It doesn't even bear thinking.
I just thought that was, you know, kind of a clever special effect, but utterly, I'm sure it'll be back. Well, I'm sure we're going to see another one of these shape-shifting robots somewhere else along the line. And if it isn't, you know, actually the impossible astronaut as this robot instead, or a robot like it, I will be shocked. But, 'cause they've obviously introduced it for something. Something deeper, something further on down the line. Or perhaps they're just going to throw it away. Just as a sort of silly aside.
I would be shocked if it comes back, in all honesty.
Interesting. Well, we'll see about that one. So what about finding out the Silence is not a race? It's a religious order.
It's a religious order.
And
interesting.
And the Brotherhood of the Question, or whatever it was. The
Headless Monks, or?
No. It was the Silence and the Institute of the Quest for the Question, or something like that. So it was two things. And they're the people who are searching for the answer, the question to the first question in the universe that's in plain sight. When they find it, then the silence will fall. Something of that nature. That was the
gist of it. It was so murky.
It was kind of pointless. And so, does that mean there's other aliens? I mean, not just the pseudo grays that we saw in Impossible Astronaut. There's going to be other aliens that are going to call themselves the Silence, or what? I mean, where is that going? Are we retconning the Silence now too?
It felt like we were.
But we know that the aliens that we know of as the Silence are there in 2011 watching the Doctor before he's killed. Because that's the first time Amy sees them. So they're still up there. And of course, we've seen the previews in other situations. But it's, you know, we're back to that religious order against. Is that the same religious order that we saw in A Good Man Goes to War? Is that the Silence, too?
It's a good question.
Or is there more than one? I mean, why not? The more the merrier.
Really don't know, but we are kind of led to believe that Madame Kavorian, or Eye Patch Lady, is working with the Silence, the Greys.
Or are they working for her? Well,
maybe,
or is she the CEO of Morpeth Jetson? I hadn't thought of it when we were watching the earlier stuff. I think we mentioned that the whole Morpeth Jetson thing was way too prominent in the Rebel Flesh and the other one. And I don't know why I didn't put two and two together. You know, the Doctor had talked about that as being early stages of technology. And I just thought, you know, yeah, Morpeth Jetson's going to come back in somehow. It's going to be, you know, it spells Phantom Jester. Or somehow it's going to come up elsewhere. But I didn't put that in a direct linear line, that it's probably Morpeth Jetson that worked all its way up to the point where they created the baby, the flesh for Amy and Melody. That it may be one long-standing corporation of of evil at some point. So I'm kind of if that will show up again, it has to show up again. Unless, of course, they just throw that away too. But
another red herring.
Another red herring. Maybe. I mean, with a story that you don't even actually bother with making it have any sense. I mean, why bother throwing in red herrings? Everything's a red herring.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, all bets are off.
Exactly. Let's talk about the regeneration of Melody Pond into, well, Melody Pond, and then ultimately her transformation into River Song there at the end by giving up her regenerations. Again, that sequence once again felt like just spending time trying to retcon into things that were previously done. River Song dies in the library. She doesn't regenerate. She doesn't have the power to regenerate.
And we find out
she can regenerate. So how do we get rid of those?
We could have been okay with the idea of her dying in there, because she states when she's saving the doctor's life in the library that the amount of energy that was required would stop both of his hearts. Okay, so if she is a cooked Time Lord, then I would imagine that she too has got two hearts. I mean, she would probably need to in order to be able to regenerate.
I get the impression she's human with Time Lord stuff tacked on.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's really hard to say. But clearly what could kill the doctor would kill her. And that's why she did it, because she knew that what needed to be done would kill him. That's why she took his place. So this whole idea of having to sacrifice the regenerations was an unnecessary one.
I think it just gets rid of an inconvenient thing of her being able to regenerate.
I didn't find it to be an illogical plot point, because we've seen – well, not seen it directly, but we have heard references before about the doctor possibly giving up regenerations in order to save others in
Modern Undead.
So that was not necessarily an unfamiliar plot point, but just the way it was done in this episode, it felt out of place and unnecessary.
It stops us from getting rid of Alex Tingston and getting someone else to play the part in the future.
Well, we can't do that. She's dead.
Well, they could have done it. They could have had another Alex King. They could have had another. Well, it doesn't really matter.
But she dies as Alex Kingston.
Well, now they've ruined that. Yeah.
I mean, they did that, but they did that in the second part in Forest of the Dead.
But that was before they had a clue. Well, and assuming they have one now. Anyway. So she goes immediately psychopathic and tries to kill the doctor, because that's what she's been programmed to do. The doctor is, of course, too quick for her to stop her from getting guns and stuff like that, but she catches him with the deadly lipstick, which somehow deactivates his ability to regenerate. The poison of the Judas tree. Cleverly named. What did you think of that plot? I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I thought Matt Smith was particularly in, frankly, poor form.
Yeah, I didn't care for. Although most people,
I don't
people
like the goofy. It's getting goofier and goofier,
and yet most people that I know loved it.
It's time to
they
pull him back.
They love the goofy.
It's time to pull him back to semi serious. Tom Baker was going over the top.
They don't like it. Most people that I know, they love the insane goofy. That they think it's fun. And to me, it's like
dumb.
Okay, you know, even though the doctor changes personality with every single regeneration, there is still some level of consistency. And there's very little here with Matt Smith, especially when he acts this loony. He does something which completely boggles the heck out of me.
Changes his clothes?
He changes into a tuxedo and top hat.
That was bizarre. And I did read somewhere somebody postulated that, you know, we don't know what happens from the time the voice activation circus in the TARDIS says you'll die in 32 minutes to the point where he shows up to, quote-unquote, try to save the day in this episode and has now changed his clothes into the tux. Those are the same clothes, or roughly the same clothes, that he wore to Amy and Rory's wedding.
Right.
And I think the person that was postulating the idea, and I don't remember who it was off the top of my head, and I apologize, I'm not stealing your idea, was that he may have, in fact, in that time, gone to Amy and Rory's wedding.
No.
Or he may have gone to the wedding at the other end of the series, which is the wedding of River Song at the end. That we may see him in that 32 minutes again later on in this show.
I don't buy it.
Well, I don't know why not? It's silly. It's ridiculous. It's the only excuse we've got for the Doctor changing his clothes was that he had to go somewhere where he had to wear those clothes. He certainly didn't need to do it to get over there just to die.
That's true. You do make a good point. I mean, it doesn't matter what the situation is. It's stupid.
Are we just still trying to enforce logic and reason over something that's just
It cannot be true.
Goofy.
At this point, this series, this particular season, cannot be saved through logic and reason. It's gone too far. It's gone over the cliff. It can't be saved now.
I'm not going to say can't, because I still feel like, you know, I still want to hold up the torch of hope here, because Mr. Moffat is an enormously clever writer, and I've seen him write some remarkably convoluted things and bring them together, but he is creating the illusion of utter chaos and not knowing where he's going.
Well, if he can pull it together, he's going to end up pulling an RTD, and it's going to be just one enormous twist right at the last second. Because not only do I see no evidence of redeeming this storyline, I see it careening over the cliff at an accelerated rate.
Yeah. I'll be very impressed, and I'll be very apologetic if he pulls it.
I will be the first one to applaud him and nominate him for a Nobel laureate, to give him a Nobel Prize for saving the series if he does indeed impress me. I'm not holding my breath.
It seems unlikely. I
quite.
I
it's like anything that he does at this point. I mean, I look back. Okay. You know, you and I had our little conversation about this episode over the weekend, and it's like no matter what solution you try and throw at this episode or at this series in general, it doesn't work. It is stupid. There is no – I cannot see for the life of me any reasonable explanation to rescue this story arc as it is going.
So did switching gears, did Amy kill a bunch of people on the Tesseract when she disabled their things?
You know,
certainly. The woman at the console sure looked like she was killed.
I had to think, okay, she just now did this. Will her name now appear in the memory banks of the Justice Department?
And, you know, there's another thing. Now, this is, I think, the first instance where they said that the sonic screwdriver was a psychic sonic screwdriver. And
yeah.
And you think about what
it's
you want it to do.
Mechanical.
Yeah, you think about what you want it to do, and then you press the button, and it does the thing. So what does Amy do when she's on the machine? She pushes, she aims the sonic screwdriver at her own badge that keeps her from being attacked, and she thinks about it, and she does it, and it goes red. So she's able to deactivate it with the psychic sonic screwdriver. She then threatens the rest of the people on the ship with doing the same to them to stop them from not killing the Doctor, but torturing Melody. And so she uses the psychic sonic screwdriver to zap all of their badges. The antibodies go after them. They start killing people, and then they all escape. We hear that from the the antibodies. They say there are only two life forms. We'll correct that. Amy and Rory are running through the thing. They're going to die. It's all terrible. And then, of course, the TARDIS comes and arrives and saves them. My question to you is this. Why not think, make my light green again, and aim the sonic screwdriver at Amy and Rory's badges, and just make them green, and then go on your way?
Because that would be logical.
Ah, there we go. That one would have made sense, yes.
That would have made sense. And at this point, what would be the point in doing something that made sense? It would stick out. It would make the rest of the story look bad. Oh, you know what? I need to sell this entire episode. So, okay, well, that looks like crap. That's definitely crap. And oh, this is just sheer rubbish. Okay, well, I can't have anything reasonable here because then that would make all these other things obviously bad.
River learns how to pilot the TARDIS. The TARDIS teaches her. Somewhere along the line, the Doctor tells her that she's a child of the TARDIS. I didn't actually see the Doctor tell her that, but somewhere along the line, the Doctor told her that. And maybe just before she got in it and took off, and the TARDIS teaches her. Hence, fixing the line from earlier in the series where she knows how to fly the TARDIS better than the Doctor, and she says, you know, I was taught by the best. Pity you weren't around that day.
Well, she does say in a later episode, in a moment of great seriousness, that the Doctor did teach her how to fly the TARDIS.
I don't remember that.
I believe it's... Oh, crud. I want to say it's in the Pandorica Opens, but I'm not sure.
I don't remember it, but...
That or the Big Bang. Not Big Bang. I think it's in Pandorica Opens.
Well, I'm not actually inclined to go rewatch any River Song episodes at this stage in time. They have pretty much basically turned me off of them. Because I'll just keep looking at the train wreck that's coming when I see the episode. Have we got anything else to pick on in this episode? I mean, that's all I can come up with. Like I said, I did watch it again this evening. I tried to watch it on an emotional level. There's some nice acting by Rory and even by Amy in this episode. I didn't think Alex Kingston's acting was very good. She was just being screwball.
Yeah.
Which is never good acting.
Other people... not everybody, but some people just really responded very highly towards Alex Kingston's presence in this episode. Go figure.
Well, I didn't think much of Matt Smith's presence in this episode, and I wish they'd get him out in the sun a little bit, because he's just beginning to look more cadaverous every time we see him. He changed his clothes. He was wearing not the tuxedo, but he was wearing a long coat in the beginning.
I actually like the long coat, but...
Well, I mean, that's Doctor Who. I mean, the Doctor should be wearing something a little more long.
I mean, it was just a minor change, I thought. And, you know, that's not too unlike what we saw Tom Baker. I mean, his outfit... And same, John Pertwee's did too a little bit. It sort of evolved a little bit, especially Tom Baker's. It evolved during the course of the show.
Up until the point John Nathan Turner got there, and then it became silly.
Oh, my God.
But then it became a costume and not clothes.
Yeah, it did.
Well, nonetheless, I'm still hopefully expectant about next week's episode. I did hear some grumbling from people who say, well, if you didn't like it, why didn't you stop watching Doctor Who? Which I thought was a bit of a lame comment. And the reason I continue to watch Doctor Who is because it can be astounding.
It can be great.
And it has the potential. And fortunately, I know next week's written by, say, Mark Gatiss instead. And
now I have hope.
See, so I... And it won't have River Song in it. And it won't be doing this silly... nonsense. It'll be a straight-up Doctor Who story, and I'm expecting it to be good. It looks scary, frankly.
Yes, it does.
So we'll be reviewing it after it comes out, and we'll be doing some other podcasts along the way on our usual shows. But until next time, oh, feel free to come into the forums and tell us how much you like the episode, or if there's somebody
else. Why?
Yeah, please tell me why. Tell me what it is. I really honestly, apart from I was just entertained, I thought the plot twists were great, or whatever, but what is it? What specific aspects of it make this a good story? I would love to know, or discuss it, or debate it, or whatever, but join us at the Fusion Patrol forums at fusionpatrol.com. And until next time, this has been Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.